Hi, Liz.
Hello, Joe.
How's it going?
It's going. I'm back from my holiday break, and I'm not thrilled.
Well, you know, we have to keep the world going, you know?
Really wish they'd keep it going without me, you know?
So that you could lay around on the beach and read books and stuff?
That's all I want to do. Is that so much to ask?
Anyway, I'm really happy to be back. This is our first episode of the year, and it's going to be a great year. We're going to be having lots of great guests.
It's going to be confusing for people. It's the first time we're recording this year.
It's the first time we're recording, right. So we'll have an episode that we recorded in December that'll drop to look like the first episode of 2026, but technically
We fooled you.
We did. Technically, this is our first recording for 2026.
Yes.
So why don't you...
cleared that up.
Yeah.
Though I will say this episode is really exciting. I think it's starting us down the super exciting path this year that I'm a nerd, so I get really stoked about. But I also know it's really important for sign shop owners. You know, we're going to dig in really deep to kind of the internal details of the, not just the sign industry. It's really any business that you own.
The nerdy numbers.
The nerdy numbers, not just numbers, but this week is numbers. So this week we're talking with Sean Borga, and he is just a wealth of knowledge. He was in the industry for 22 years.
Owned a sign shop for 22 years.
A sign shop for 22 years. He bought that sign shop, built that sign shop, rolled out of that sign shop with a beautiful exit strategy. And we will talk about that at some point. That's not what today is about. But since then, he developed a company called Your Biz Coach that teaches other sign companies how to be profitable and what you need to focus on in order to increase your profit margin successfully.
And just increase the value of the business and the value of your own life. Like, I like that part of the conversation too.
And then the other thing that he's also doing now, which is really cool, it's specific to the sign industry. He just ventured into lead generation. So Simple Lead Gen is his newest venture along with Your Biz Coach. And that's lead generation specific to the sign industry. It sounds like it's been super successful for his beta clients. So look in the description below. We're going to have information on all of that stuff and how to contact Sean. But for this conversation, buckle up, dudes. It's a good one. But I think the most important thing that you should look out for in this episode is really just understanding your bottom line, understanding the numbers you need to understand. Even if you have a CPA, it's just the things you need to understand to make sure you understand how to quote and how to be profitable. So I think we all care about that.
Well, before we get started, we want to, of course, thank our sponsors. So thank you very much to Inktabo. So if you folks don't know, I'm pretty passionate about Inktabo because they bring you SignTracker. So SignTracker is a project management system, quoting system, a file management system for your sign shop. And if you go to inktabo.com, you can learn more about SignTracker and you can learn more about the other productivity products that Inktabo offers to the sign and print and garment industry.
Yes. Also, our friends at Sign Builder Illustrated, whose website is
signshop.com.
Never going to remember it. Because what I was thinking was ISA.
Yes. And then let's talk about ISA just for a second, because, you know, Liz and I have been invited as the Behind the Signs co-hosts to be influencers this year at ISA. ISA Expo in Orlando, Florida. And, yeah, and we should know the dates because we have to buy plane tickets soon.
I believe it's April 8th through the 11th, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. But look out on our Behind the Signs group. If you're not already a part of it, please be sure to join us on Facebook. Our Behind the Signs community is over how many?
16,500 and growing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Great place for you to ask questions and ask for help, which we talk about in this episode is really important.
The only bad question is the question not asked. So, and also just in the show notes, I will say, if you are Behind the Signs follower and you're listening to this podcast and you're going to the ISA Expo, we have a promo code that will get you in for free. So we will put that in the show notes as well. So please think about going to ISA. If you've never been, it's an amazing experience in the, it's like Sign Shop Disneyland. All right, guys, let's kick this off and get with Sean. Sean Borga. Sean, welcome to today's episode of Behind the Signs. We're super excited to have you. You know, it's funny because what we're going to talk about today, I think, is going to be really helpful to the Behind the Signs community, hopefully to other folks in the sign industry that might pick it up some other way. But the one thing about, you know, I'm hoping that this year's series of podcasts with Liz and I are all focused on how can we just really dig into helping sign shop owners.
Some would say this is the boring stuff.
Yeah. Today's episode is.
No, I think what we have in store for the topics, I think we're going to start digging into. It's not the exciting, fun, creative stuff, but it's so important.
It's the most impactful for a healthy business for sure. And so what a way to kick this off with having you on, Sean, because you're an expert at this. So one of the questions, you know, we get questions all the time that come in through the Behind the Signs community, and it's also part of the sign up process. So the other day, a new community member signed up, and I'm not going to say the name, you know, protect the innocent here. But the question was, how do I not be afraid to ask for help? And I was like, oof, you know, I get it, man, you know, because sometimes you feel like an island out there when you're a sign shop owner.
It is hard too, because the industry itself is kind of rough and tumble. Like, it's kind of filled with people that do live kind of within the construction industry-ish or adjacent to the construction industry. And they're just a little bit more rough and tumble. They rib each other and rough each other's feathers a little bit. And we don't have a lot of forums that allow for you to ask for help without feeling embarrassed.
And I guess I was one of those oddballs, because as I was growing, I was so eager to learn, to the point where I had an HR consultant, because we weren't large enough to have that person on staff. And she had to tell me one day, like, stop learning. Let's just implement something for 6 months and get it to work. And I'm like, no, this is so much fun.
It's actually so funny that you said that, because our next month's guest, an HR consultant. Because it's needed. But well, Sean, let's kick this off with, you know, I read through your entire coaching website, and we could probably just talk about all the stuff you wrote on your website and talk for hours, but there's some really good stuff there. But a couple things. One is, you've been in the industry for you had 22 years as a sign shop owner. So why don't you, talk to us a little bit about that, and, you know, and then we'll transition into the coaching part of what you're doing now.
But I think that it'd be really important for people to hear, like, how did you start, grow, and roll off successfully? Because I think people want to know that.
So basically, let's journey back, 20-some years ago. Wow. So came out of college. And when I was in college, my mom had said, hey, why don't you buy a striping machine that's for sale in the paper, you know, newspaper. So Elizabeth, you probably don't remember what newspaper was. Joe, you like call the ad in the newspaper. So I started with a parking lot striping machine when I was 19 years old. So I'm going to Purdue. We had a baby when we were 17, 18, got married at 18. So now I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a business person, and I'm going to school full time. Fast forward, my degree was in graphic design. So at that time, as my junior year, I had the first iMac. So a little 11-inch, 15-inch screen, whatever. I don't think it was 15. I think it was like 11 inches. And it wasn't even a class. It was a side class. I forget what they call them. And so once I graduated, I'm like, I don't really want to work for someone. So we started a parking lot maintenance business. And we were in a networking group. And in that networking group one day, about 8 years into the business, a gentleman pops up and he says, hey, I'm selling this sign company. I'm going to put it out to the group first before I put it on the market. And I'm like, oh, okay, sign company. Well, so we talked, and I'm like, oh, cool. I can use my degree that I forgot all about. I can be cool in the summertime because I can have air conditioning as opposed to sitting in a parking lot for 12 hours a day. And in the wintertime, I can make money and sit in the heat. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. So I had an accountant look at it that went to church with us. He said, it's fantastic. Bye. I said, okay, cool. So we bought that. I was 25 years old or something, and thought I was Superman. I'll keep the other business going, keep this going. Then I had another partner come up and say, hey, why don't we start a car lot? Well, I'm a car guy. So I'm like, oh yeah, I bought and sold cars when I was in college. You know, we'd buy a car and drive a car for a month, sell it, make a grand, do it again. So I'm like, yeah. And so I had all three of these businesses figured out at last as time went on. Can't do all three at once and be successful. If you're doing three things, you're just doing them all okay. So we sold the parking lot maintenance business, and that one went bye-bye. So now we have two. Well, then the sign shop funded the car lot for 8 years as we were trying to do both. And we got in the market at the wrong time, and we had too much money in it. We had leases, so we couldn't break the leases. So the sign shop funded that. So I bought a little sign shop, $160,000 in sales. So basically a job. And didn't really even focus on growth past maybe $250,000 or so for that 8 years, because I was juggling sign shop, car lot, sign shop, car lot. And once we closed the car lot, then I started focusing on this company. And that's when we really started taking off. We had a large, large client that we would do emergency work for. They'd call us and say, hey, can you do unit numbers? You know, do 15, 20 cut vinyl unit numbers, aerial font, 6-inch tall, blah, blah, blah. Well, one day they called me up and they said, hey, we want you to do all of our fulfillment. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean? And they said, oh, you know, million plus decals annually, anything from, you know, oil grease goes here and 1 inch by half inch to, you know, 12 by 14 inch. But we want you to fulfill. We want you to warehouse. We want you to do inventory, everything. And I'm like, I have no clue what I'm doing. Like, I do cut vinyl. What are you talking about? And she's like, that's fine. You can third party source. We don't care. We just want to use you. That's the relationship we had built. So I'm like, okay, I'll do some research. And they said, but you cannot use company X. Well, company X is the only company I could find third party at the time that could fulfill everything that needed completed. So I'm like, okay. So I talked to company X, who I already had a relationship with. And I said, here's the deal. If you want to do this with me, great. But you have to be invisible. Like, there cannot be, there's no, you don't do any interaction. They can't know about it. I learned a hard lesson on that one. So company X sends me a quote, and they send it in Excel. Well, at the time, I did not know Excel had tabs. So in their quote, I just went and changed out my logo to their logo, and I updated the pricing. And then I didn't pay attention to tabs. Well, they had their fax cover sheet and their letterhead and their as tabs along the bottom. Well, I do a save as, send it off, and I get a call back like later that day or the next day. And my contact at our client is like, hey, are you using company X? And I'm like, no, well, why are you asking? She's like, well, did you know there's tabs? And I'm like, no. It's like, okay, let's have a conversation. I said, here's the deal. You're hiring me. I'll take care of them. And so long story short, they failed 6 months later after our client had 25,000 pieces of just one decal on their shelf, and a whole fiasco went into finding a third party, yada, yada. Well, I say that to go, that's how we grew. So that client pretty much doubled us right off the bat once they came on board. And then we started learning how to, you know, we learned how to fulfill, how to manage. We found another source, built a great relationship with that source, third party source, for 15 years before we sold the business. It was a fantastic relationship. Our client never left us. They always loved us. We took care of that problem. It wasn't the easiest, but a lot of learning, a lot of lessons. And then we started from there. That taught us a whole lot of lessons. How do you manage third party? So we did a lot of third-party installations. We did a lot of third-party sourcing, not just for that client, but for fabricated letters, for, you know, monument signs, anything like that sort. We didn't do any of that in-house. We even did some printing outsourced. And so along the way, that's how we grew. We just started building. And then we weren't even ready for an exit. COVID hit. We had a great project, carried us through the end of April. May was deader than a doornail, and it was a nice relaxation. Like, okay, clean the shop, organize. We're back to like the day we moved in. And then June just started taking off. And about March, I lost my assistant and my manager to healthcare. So, you know, both their healthcares closed up due to COVID. And so they both had to go home. And so I'm like, okay, I went down to my wife in June and I said, I've got this evaluation a past client of ours gave us. He kept bugging me about, hey, you want to sell? I'm like, nope, we're too young. And I said, we've got this evaluation or we're going to have to hire a manager. an assistant, and another production person. And we're only a 10-person shop. So, you know, kind of like starting halfway over, and we're 49 years old. What do you want to do? And she says, if option A is good, I'm good to, you know, semi-retire and do a change of pace. And I'm like, okay. So we sold without any structure in place that we should have. And we just got lucky. We got about 3x earnings, which is abnormal for where we sat, but we were the first roll of an acquisition and roll up. So if we would have been number 3, 4, or 5, we probably would have been like 1 to 1.5x earnings. So we just happened to get lucky, right time, right place. And sorry, that's the long-winded answer to the question.
Did you seek out a broker for giving you that valuation of your business, or how did that just kind of came to you?
Yeah. So basically he was a past client and he had sold his veterinary practice. Then he bought a franchise, sold it, and then decided to become a broker. And so he kept softly bugging me like, hey, are you interested? And so I'm like, no, we're good. You know, just like a lot of people in our industry, like, no, this is our retirement gig. We're good. We're not going to sell till we're ready to retire. And he just said, hey, we'll give you an evaluation. I was like, fine, whatever. Just kind of to get him off my back. Like, okay, fine. You know, and we had a bookkeeper on staff that was pretty much an accountant without a degree. And so Hasun, anything he needs, just give him the reports, yada, yada. And then, you know, the rest is, we put it on blindly. I said, okay, if we're going to do this, you know, once my wife said, yeah, I like plan A, we put it on the market blindly. So we didn't have name, city, anything. It was just, you know, Northwest Indiana. And we had, 4 or 5 offers within 60 days, I think it was. And so, yeah, we had an LOI signed in like 90 days. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. Now, 2 or 3 of those were buyouts, like earnouts. And I was like, no. If I'm selling, I'm selling. If I'm not, I'm not. It's there's no in between. So.
Right. And I think that, to be honest, that's a conversation that could take easily 1 to 2 episodes, just the process of selling your company. Yeah, I will say, though, for anyone looking into that, just the short answer is the first step is get evaluation of your business. Like, that's, you need to know what you're selling before you sell it. And I will say one last thing on that, Sean, is I know you mentioned having like a specific brokerage for the industry. And that is really important too. Like, I don't know, hint, if you ever want to develop that, because our industry really doesn't fit anywhere. It's so unique that when people are positioning you for sale and they're writing something to market your business, it's like they're comparing it to the design industry, but that's so vast, they'll compare it to film. And it's like, that is not a good comparison. Like, it's just not, it doesn't make any sense, you know, and or they'll compare it to a construction company. And it's like, well, that's never going to make this company look that great. It's not a construction company. So it's just, yeah, super important.
And I'm going to be writing some pieces on this, because it's really like you have a design agency on the front end, regardless of what level it is. You know, it's maybe it's your level, maybe it's, you know, just someone designing electrical cans. Then you have a pre-press or production area. Then you have an installation business, and then some have a fulfillment business like we did. So you're managing 4 different businesses under one roof. How do you market that? Like, who's going to come in and understand that? You know, if you haven't, you know,
someone else in the sign industry, like, yeah. That's what it comes down to, is sign industry. It's just,
yeah. And how do you run that kind of a business? Right. It's complicated.
Right.
For and most of the businesses are small mom and pops, but yet they're still very complicated, even though they're simple businesses sort of, but they're very complicated.
And then on top of that, you've got those 4 businesses under the roof, and they're all custom. So it's not even, we're just putting widget A out, widget B out, widget C, widget D. It's custom, 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 custom. So it's like, holy crap. Yeah, and I never thought about that when you're in it, you're just in it. Like, you figure it out, or you get training, or you figure out where your holes are and you learn how to do it. And once I'm out, I'm like, I was talking actually with my coach, and I'm like, holy crap. Yeah, it took some brain power to do that. Wow, I was smart. Okay, cool.
It's a lot, for sure. One thing that you wrote on your website, well, your tagline is it's a great hook, right? Escape the 70-hour prison and build a printing, sign, and apparel business that thrives without you. And when I read that, I was thinking, well, you just, you know, the 70-hour prison part definitely was me for a lot of years. But I'm assuming that that came, was that you?
Yes, to a degree. And then all the stories I hear, I mean, just, you know, people talking, like, I mean, you just hear it all the time. I'm working so much and my pay doesn't compensate and, you know, it doesn't correlate in any way. And I'm going to put more. And then you hear, oh, I need more sales to fix it. Well, no, wait a minute. If you do more sales and you already are doing 70 hours or 50 or 60, more sales isn't going to fix the problem. And so people don't look at the internal, how to fix the problem. And I'll go back to, I had a sales coach for a while. I think I had him for maybe 6 months, and I even gave him an office. He'd come in once a week, and we had this awful, just awful culture. But at the time I didn't know about culture. I didn't know what culture was. I didn't know. I just knew Joe's stabbing, you know, Elizabeth in the back, and Elizabeth's talking about me. And then Susie's talking about, and all this. And his point was, well, do you get work out the door? I'm like, yeah, but it sucks. Like, even for me as the owner, it sucks to come into work. Like, I don't come in going, yes, on the way in. I'm like, ah, I got to deal with this crap again. And his point was, no, you're getting stuff out the door. Just keep selling. And I was like, no, we need to fix the inside so that it runs smoother and then increase the sales.
It's not that those folks are terrible employees or bad humans. They're just stressed, you know, and confused.
Well, and I hired them. I mean, so, you know, that, I mean, it wasn't, I didn't blame anyone. It was just like, no, we got to fix this. And yeah, you can't. And the other thing too, is you can't fix what you don't know, which goes back to the question of how do I ask for help? Well, if your pride gets in the way, or you're worried about it's a dumb question, then you can never get to that point where you understand, because you never asked the question. So you're always stuck in that 70-hour prison, that hell, that, you know, you got to ask and just not.
Well, and the thing is too, that's crazy about the sign industry. And I'm sure there's other industries that are this way too, but, you know, the hustle culture, right? Which I get it. Everyone needs to hustle hard. You know, you want to make it happen. You got to hustle hard. And there's times when we do have a 70-hour work week. I mean, maybe there's a big goal you want to hit, but it's an exception. But I feel like in the sign industry, you talk to folks and it's a badge of honor because it's the only answer. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, I have to keep working harder, 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 harder to make it happen. And then at the end of it, you're just killing yourself. You're burning out.
It's like the trope of, how are you doing? Oh, really busy. And it's like, well,
that, yeah. Is that good? I'm really busy. Look at me.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and I'm just as guilty of it. I was on a cruise last week with my daughter and we parked in Cozumel and I'm on the phone working. Like, oh, I finally have service. Let me handle this fire at work. And that's not the usual for me, but it does happen. You know, it is the industry, unfortunately. And I think there are ways to go around it. For the most part, I am with you on the business that thrives without you. That is nice. I've put that to the test a few times with work travel out of the country where I just was not able to contact the team. And it's like, well, your job is to make sure you have a job. So keep it going.
Well, if you're, you know, I feel like if you're running your shop right now and you're, you know, like the Tasmanian devil and it's just a dust storm around you, there's a lot of things that probably need to be fixed and we can't fix them all today in this episode. So I think some of the important things that come up all the time in the behind the science community is generally around quoting and revenue and, you know, understanding all that. So the other thing that you put on your website and it screamed at me was printing sign and apparel business owners are trapped. They're working more hours while pay stays flat. I was like, oh, and I would say this to Elizabeth all the time. Cause you know, when we first started Sign Tech International, that was my first sign company. Elizabeth grew up in that shop. You know, I cursed her by dragging her into the sign industry, but you know, it was successful. And I'm grateful, you know, and we also exited nicely. But, you know, when we grew the business from just two of us, my business partner and I, and we were sales guys, and so we were sales focused and we had to learn all the other stuff, you know, and at first we were outsourcing all the fabrication and installation, eventually bought up a couple small companies and you know, made a single company. But when we were doing, we were still working too many hours, but when we had like 15 employees, we were making, you know, really decent money. We had enough money to pay all our employees well. We had medical benefits, and we were probably still doing the 60, 70 hours a week. I'm not going to lie, but yeah, it definitely was. The 60, 70 hours a week kept going as we grew it to over the years. $1 million a year we added in revenue every single year for 10 years. I never made another dime. My pay went up a little bit, you know. I mean, we took really good care of our employees, and so a big expense was there, and they deserved it. They worked super hard too. But you know, I don't know. Maybe it was not understanding some of the things we're going to talk about as clearly as I should. Maybe it wasn't enough controls in place. There was probably a lot of things to look at. But all I know is that when I sold my business, even though I was grateful for the experience and had all the years under my belt and, you know, had success with it, man, the relief of just unloading it, because I was so burnt out. And I don't think it needs to be that way.
Now, I will say, like, I know we've touched on this. You briefly mentioned it, Sean, but culture is really important. We've talked about this so much. I'm a huge advocate for internal company culture. We have mastered that at our company. It is wild to me how we've created some level of a cult. I don't know how it's happened, but we have. We do have a little cult, and it's great, and we enjoy it. And they, as gross as this is nowadays to say, they are our family. Like, we support them if they leave. We are proud of them in their growth in the company, outside of the company. They are a part of our lives. But I think that the other side of things that helps you grow smarter is the way I'll say that, is understanding, like Joe said, it's what comes up in Behind the Signs all the time. How to quote. How are you quoting accurately? How do you develop a system or use an existing system to quote accurately? What does that even mean? Like, how did you kind of do that in your shop?
So I never got to the software stage. That was one of our goals. So I did it kind of old school. I had an Excel spreadsheet, and it was cool.
That's
how Sign Tracker, the original Sign Tracker, was just an Excel, the whole program of Excel stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and it was awesome because, so I broke down my whole company. So I went, okay, we'll use just generic numbers, but if we have 10,000 square feet and 1,000 square feet, well, let's say 400 square feet is my accounting office. 600 is my design office. And maybe it's, so that's 1,000. So maybe 8,000 is production and 1,000 was upstairs, my office and common space. So I broke down my labor. I broke down my cost of space. I broke down. So like I would take for now for 26, once I had 25 numbers down, I would take my average variable costs and just average those for 25. And I would create a cost per zone. So I had my production cost at X, and I would take my employees, and I had them all salaried at the time. So when I was in business, I kept everyone salaried. It made it so much easier in my head. It was right before they changed all the rules. So, you know, everyone's happy. I paid them well, but it was salary. So now I can say, okay, this space cost me X. And Joe, like you were talking about before, if you're paying someone $20 an hour on average, well, you're not paying them $20. You're paying them 20 plus workers count, plus Social Security matching, plus Medicare matching, plus was it federal? And I don't think you do state anymore. It's been a while. But I took all that and I went, okay, when I'm doing production, this is what it costs me. And so I had a line item for my costs. So I could put my labor cost in, I could put my hard cost of materials in, and then I could do, even on the design end, we usually did a guesstimate of hours, but I knew my design cost. So I had my cost column, and then I could my variable I could do was, what percentage of markup do I want? But when I did my markups, they were true net. I would even put in fudge factor, like, okay, the degree of this project is going to be much harder, so it's going to have more room for some kind of error, some kind of reprint, some kind of, you know, something going on. So I would even put in my fudge factor, and I would put my cost, and that would have a markup on it even. So when I did a project, I could say I wanted 40%, 25%, you know, depending on what I'm doing. And so when I figured it out, that's what we did. And at the end, we were doing, after paying my wife, after paying myself, after us having all the benefits of ownership, we were still making 25% net. So it was, yeah, it was awesome. And we were, we were in the 1.4 range for the last 4 or 5 years that we were in business. So, you know, we did fairly well for a small business, only 8 to 10 people, during that phase. But that's how we did it. It was just a simple little Excel sheet, but man, I could go in and we would track a few projects just to make sure, hey, am I missing something? Do I need to add more fudge factor in this sense? And typically it was, my number was very conservative and we usually get better. So
yeah, I think that's really important because it's just like, how do you even, how do you start? People don't understand what all goes into the cost of doing business. So how do you start that? So that, I think that's a really good explanation. Thank you.
Yeah. And the difference between like the variable costs, labor, and the fixed costs, like, hey, if you have no sales for the month of January, you still have to pay the light bill and the rent and that's, yeah. You know, and then how does that impact what you do for sales for the rest of the year? It's just, it's a lot to think about. And I think, you know, it comes up in the community a lot is how do I quote accurately? You know, how do you learn? Cause you know, for me, like I was spoiled, right? So when we first started in the sign business, my business partner and I, because we outsourced literally everything, we would get a quote from the fabricator, we'd get a quote from the install, would calculate some design time, some admin time, some permit time, and pretty much try to double it. And then, you know, so quoting was easy because we were getting the numbers from, you know, from vendors.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that managing the vendors was that easy. You know.
I don't know about easy.
Well, not easy. Okay. Nothing was ever easy. You're right. Nothing was ever easy. But, you know, but when it, yeah. But when we did finally have, you know, we bought a shop and we brought, you know, it was in a different part of town. We brought everyone under one roof, you know, and then it was all of a sudden, man, we're not really making any money. We're struggling to make payroll. Like, what's going on? And so, you know, we eventually get a really good shop foreman that understood how signs are manufactured. So he sort of helped train us to, you know, look at all the raw materials that were needed. What's the markup on the materials? What's the, you know, what's the fudge factor? Like you said, especially on materials, right? Things happen. And it could be as simple as not nesting a sheet of aluminum, maximizing that and having more drop than you should or whatever it might be. And then the same with installs, things that are, you know, unforeseen. So eventually, you know, he sort of taught us, swore at us a lot too, actually, and chain smoke.
It's the only way you learn.
That's true. I only learn when people beat me up. You know, so, but how did you guys handle that? You know, I mean, eventually we grew like he taught us and we eventually hired an estimator that came out of a construction background. And so at least he understood, you know, that person understood how to put together quotes based on material and labor and all that stuff. But who did the estimating, first of all, in your shop? Did you do it? Or?
It was a breakup of me. And then I had managers off and on. So I might have a manager for 2 or 3 years. You know, like one time I brought up a designer that she was fantastic, but then her husband moved and she moved back to Kansas. And so she was only with us a couple of years. So it bounced from me to my manager, but typically it was very easy. Like the process that I talked about just now, I taught my team so that they understood as we went through, you know, hey, if we have a head strike, and we don't fix why the head strike happened, then now these prices that we gave. So it's, Elizabeth, I go back to you, what you said. You guys have to keep your jobs. And it wasn't made in a threatening way. It was, you know, if you're not going to watch that, hey, we had a head strike because the material was not kept in a proper storage manner or whatever it was, then you're the one putting your job on the line, you know, and not from a mean factor, but just from a, hey, we all got to work together.
I think that people like that to a certain degree. It gives them ownership, especially on a smaller team like you were, like I am. It gives people just such clout and such ownership and pride when it's done right. And they like to keep doing that. So,
and we would have morning meetings, and you're right. Like they would be like, yeah, we printed off, you know, miles of printing yesterday and no problem, no head strike, no this laminator didn't, you know, fall on our face and, you know, and they were excited. And so But, and then we also, Joe, like you said, with your employees, I mean, we took care of them in the end too, you know, like Christmas. I mean, one year we rented a cabin a couple hours away and we all went down and we had dinner and we went out, did stuff. And then we had, you know, hot tub and, you know, we just got away. And it was bring your spouses. And, you know, so we had a huge cabin and things like that, that we were just trying to get camaraderie under the fact that they understood they weren't business people, but at least they understood why we did what we did, you know? And I think that was a huge part of it.
Yeah, we did a lot of national accounts at my company. And so even though the project managers didn't do the quoting, they managed the projects off the estimate sheets, and they were always challenged, you know, to beat the budget. And of course, there was a real sense of pride, and there was always little bonuses tied into beating the budget and that kind of stuff too. So, but we ultimately grew, like I said, to a point where we had a full-time estimator. And, you know, and it's just a hard part of the business. A lot of times when I get asked, you know, about that, especially from electric sign shops, right? I was like, look, if you're the owner and you're doing the quoting, you need to know how signs are built. I'm not saying they have to go out and learn how to weld. You know, I mean, I can't build a sign to save my life, but I can tell you the processes, and I understood it. You know, I understood how that, hey, this much angle went into a cabinet, or this, you know, this many components. You could look at the drawings, you know. You have to really learn about how signs are made.
Yeah. I think that holds true though, even if you're brokering, right? Like you need to know that you're not getting taken advantage of, because if someone sees you coming from a mile away and they know you don't know what you're doing, that sign's going to be really expensive. But if you can talk the talk, there are no shortcuts, but if you can talk the talk and you understand it, then, and a lot of people that are brokering do understand it. But take the time to learn it. I obviously came from a manufacturing background, so I had a little bit of a deeper understanding going into this, but I think whether you're building signs or whether you're brokering signs, you need to understand how it's made so that you're paying the right price for it.
Coming from, you know, putting on your consulting hat now, right? So if you're going into a shop and, you know, the office manager is doing the quoting, you know, no, whatever it might be, it's a mess, right? Like quotes aren't consistent. Like, where do you start to help a shop owner kind of get that part of the business together?
I guess I'd back up to what you both just said. It's, do you understand every facet? So, you know, when we had our shop, we brokered a lot and then we did things in-house, but I couldn't turn on a printer. I couldn't laminate. I could do some very, very simple vinyl graphic install, but it'd take me four times as long as my wife could go knock it out, you know, but I understood every process. So even on my third party, we did no manufacturing in-house on the fabrication side. So, but boy, I knew how to do it just like you were talking about, Joe, because I would call my fabricator and I'd go, okay, walk me through how we're going to do this. Here's my thoughts. And then each time I would have a project, he'd be like, well, dude, you nailed it. Dude, you nailed it. And then I'd have another one to be like, okay, I think I understand this, but how do I do it? And I would do the same thing with my installers. So I would go back in the instance you just said and go, does the owner understand it? Because if the owner doesn't understand it, he can't teach it to anyone. If the owner understands it, then it's time to build a process. Because if there's no consistencies, then where's the process? And in that scenario, it would sound like we're just kind of willy-nilly, hey, you know, we'll throw this together. And, you know, putting together a whole process might include example projects. This much material goes into this type of project. And if you have questions, you can go ask this person. You know, and that would be built into that process. But I would go back to the original. Does the owner know if that person's reporting to the owner? If the person reports to the manager, then still, does the owner know it? Does the manager know it? You know, does the hierarchy know it enough to teach it? And then is there a process to follow after they're taught?
Yeah. I know when I'm talking to sign shop owners, because I still teach a lot of classes around sign tracker, you know, and it's fun for me because I know the system so well, but the big part of it always comes to when I'm teaching about the quoting. Well, doesn't it just tell me what the price is? Well, I don't know your variables, you know.
Yes.
The system does. I mean, it's just a system. I mean, it's a good system, but you know, it's just a system, and you have to be able to input the correct data and build templates. And that one thing I always tell shop owners too is, you know, if you can build some templates, right? So whether it's sign tracker, hopefully it is. I'm a big super fan, but let's say if it's not, whatever system you might use to do your quoting and project management, you know, build out some templates if it allows you to on the simpler stuff. The stuff that, you know, banners, yard signs, simple site signs, those sorts of things. And even if you're, as the owner, you're the second set of eyes that looks at the quote before it goes out and says, yep, that looks good. Good. Send it out to the client. That's fine. And I kind of feel like you can do this in stages where if you've taught other folks in the shop how to do the simpler stuff, then it leaves the big complicated stuff for you to work on, you know, cause those are the important jobs, right? If you're going to build a pylon sign or a channel letter set or ADA signs like Elizabeth does here, she does all those sorts of projects, you know, bottom line is you just got to know the processes of how signs are built and installed.
You can't track, you can't improve, you can't build on anything you don't understand.
So I think it's time to nerd out a little bit on my type of nerding out, which is very exciting for everybody. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Get an accountant, get a CPA, like that you have a good relationship with that you can ask questions to. This all goes back to asking for help. It's okay to not know everything. You're not expected to know everything, but you should be learning. So ask for help. This is one of the areas. There are people, this is their specialty. Get a CPA.
I will say one thing, the only dumb thing about about asking for help is not asking for help, right?
Exactly. I was just going to say the only dumb question is the one you don't ask.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually one of the things, like when we hire someone new, that's one of the things we say, like, ask questions. The only way you're going to learn is to ask questions, especially with our PM team. Like if a vendor says a word you're not familiar with, ask what they mean. Don't pretend like you know it. Just ask. So now I think, though, we should talk about the nerdy things that you should just kind of be familiar with. We talked a little bit about it, the nerdy numbers. We talked a little bit about it a minute ago. You kind of started to explain labor burden. I don't think a lot of people really understand that. So I do just want to repeat that you have to understand the cost of your payroll isn't the cost of someone's salary. It's the salary plus all of the other fees associated with that salary. That is any sort of tax match, which you have to do. If you offer any benefits, if you obviously your workers' comp, the cost on your workers' comp, plus health insurance, 401k, those types of benefits. So you have to just understand that it's more than just, I pay this person X amount a year for salary. But I think it would be helpful for people to understand kind of shop overhead, right? And you went a little bit into it. You obviously got real deep in this in your shop.
I liked what you said about breaking your shop up by regions. That was pretty good. Yeah.
That's what dreams are made of for an accountant. So top notch. But not everyone's going to do that. And I think it's okay. You don't have to get that deep into it if you don't want to. There are other ways, but just understanding like variable costs versus fixed costs. Do you want to shed a little bit of light on that?
Yeah. So variable costs would be your utilities, anything that varies. So you have insurance, typically insurance is one cost per annual year, and then it might change the next year. So that's a fixed cost. Rent's a fixed cost. If you have a car payment, so on and so forth, fixed costs are just not going to change. Now, like I said, if you want to make things a little easier in your head as an owner, you could just take an average of your previous year. And it's going to be relatively close, typically. I mean, if you have 120 degree summer versus typically it's 75 degrees all summer, okay, your AC bill is going to go up, obviously. So things might change a little, but otherwise in overtime. So for those of you that pay hourly, your variable is going to be overtime. So for me, I had exempt employees under that salary. So, you know, I would pay them a bonus, but that was under my choice. So those are kind of the variables versus fixed.
And I think that the basic definition for you to remember is just kind of what you said. Variable cost is something that varies month to month. A fixed cost is something that stays the same annually for that year. So it could be rent could go up the next year, but that's still a variable cost because it stays the same for the 1 year.
It's still a fixed cost.
Fixed cost.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Fixed cost.
Yes. Well, I know. I will say, so now let's think about variable costs and fixed costs and what a shop rate is, right? Because now you have to somehow marry those two, don't you, Sean? I mean, like say if it's $1,000 a month is your fixed cost and, you know, $1,000 a month is all your variable, like your labor costs and all that stuff. Do you have to combine those two and then divide it by the employee? Because how do you come up with that shop rate? Like, oh, we charge $90, like the retail shop rate, right? $90 an hour, $120 an hour, whatever. And then of course, then you have field rates that are different because you have different cranes. And like, how do you think about that? How do you help shops think about what they charge the customer?
So kind of goes back, like we said, I went a little bit more in depth, but basically I never got to the gross profit includes this number between gross sales and gross profit and then net profit. I kind of tweaked mine differently to include a lot of things. So I threw myself into a cost underneath gross profit. So I kind of broke mine differently. And I went, okay, I'm an admin. I'm below. All my other employees are above. And so really it's covering all those costs. So I would take the averages of last year's variable costs, put that in along with my rent, along with all my fixed costs, divide that by 12, which gives us our monthly costs, divide that by 40, or I mean by 4, which gives us our weekly, divided by 40, and that gives us our hourly cost. So now at our hourly cost, we know, okay, what margin do we need to make to, you know, survive? I mean, your family as an owner has to have X to survive. So you start, that's how I looked at it. And then I went, okay, now I want to position my company where maybe the average is 5 to 7% on that. Well, I don't want to make 5 to 7%. I don't get excited to get up in the morning, make 5%. So I'm like, okay, how do I position my company to where we didn't really compete on project and price? We went in and we had relationships. They knew what we did. We specialized in an area, just like Elizabeth was talking about before this camera, before we had our start of our meeting here. And it was, we positioned ourselves where we just went in, and I would even start the conversation with a client. And sorry if I'm going off on a rabbit trail, I think it kind of flies. So when I met with a client, I found out I wasn't the best salesman because I'm more of a solutions provider and I'm a relationship guy. So I'd walk in and I just point blank, like, hey, Elizabeth, okay, we're looking at these four walls and you want to do X with it. Okay, well, what if we turn that into a marketing piece? And now we created this marketing tool, probably physically one of the biggest ones you have in the toolbox, but not the only tool in the toolbox. And how do we get that to work with your marketing, whole marketing campaign? And so as in a university, I'd be like, okay, hey, we're stopping at this point with a prospective student and their parents. And we're going to design wall A for the parents. Why do you want to spend $40,000 at Purdue? We're going to design wall B to say, hey, Susie, Johnny, why do you want to go to Purdue over Clemson or something, da, da, da. And wall C and D are going to be all of what the department did, all the accomplishments and wows and ooh, they turn around. They're like, oh, that's a cool project. Okay, well, now we made this and we would have our client as part of the example. Stop, go, oh, okay. Hey, Mr. Mrs. I forgot your packet in my office. Here, you look at this wall. Susie, Johnny, you look at this wall. Oh, you can all look at this wall. I'm gonna go grab your packet and I'll be right back. Okay. Well, now I created a marketing tool, not a crap on the wall project. And everyone else that came in would be, oh yeah, we can put stuff on the wall. You give us pictures. We can put stuff on the wall. Now, with that said, we typically didn't have competition. So now I move myself into, and I would also ask in that same scenario, sorry, let me back up again. Elizabeth, what's your budget? And they, you know, they kind of, oh my gosh, you want all my money. It's like, no. I can sell you a Cadillac, a Rolls Royce, and a Chevy. They all get you point A to point B. If I show you a Rolls Royce and you have a Chevy budget, we're done.
Literally use those same exact word every single project. Just. Okay, I can sell you a sign made of gold, but if you don't have budget for a sign made of gold, then I'm going to sell you the best thing that you can afford. Like,
yep. And if you show them the Rolls Royce and they have a Chevy budget, all they're going to do is get pissed off and you don't have a relationship and you're never going to work together. And all they're going to remember is, man, they showed me this and I couldn't afford it. So once that phrase is said, they'll just go, oh, okay, well, our budget's X. Probably Chevy, you know? And so then I start walking and I'm talking out loud like I always do. And I'm like, oh, this would be cool. Oh, wait, that doesn't fit the budget. And they're like, whoa, wait, go back. What were you thinking? I'm like, well, that's more of a Cadillac or Rolls Royce budget. Well, okay, go ahead, walk through it and see what it is. And typically we would go from a Chevy to a Cadillac or a Rolls Royce. I'm just excited to do what I'm doing. I'm not even upselling. I'm just like, this would be so cool. This would be cool. This would be cool. And then I'm like, but I got to tone it down at times. And then, and imagine, you know, inevitably there's like, oh no, we have more money. But with that said, now I moved us from, yeah, from like 10 to 15% margins to 25, 30% margins, heck, some projects, 40, 50% margins. But it was strategically positioning us, getting the team to understand why we're doing this and why we didn't do banners walking in off the street and why we didn't do this and why we didn't do that. And once the whole team's moving that direction, oh my gosh, it's awesome. Because now they're all buying in and they're part of it. They're like, oh, we're doing fun projects now. Like every project was still work and still had problems and hiccups and yada, yada. But it was still, we're moving in a fun direction that everyone enjoyed.
And really, you kind of covered some of my other questions. But, you know, the other thing I think it's really good to understand is, how do you know what your break-even point is? Because I don't think people know what that is in order to go up, right? Even if you, like, if you've already given a quote out, understanding where your break-even point, you're past that. Like, you've given your quote, do not discount your work. Ask what scope needs to be removed. That's how you discount your work. I can value engineer this. That's a way to do it. And you can find, you know, cheaper materials to build the sign out of. It might be making it smaller. It might, you know, there are ways to value engineer a design. And the other thing is, what scope would you like to remove? If you want to save money, what scope would you like to remove? That's, don't just give a $500 discount. You should learn your break-even price, but, or break-even point, but don't just discount it after, because it makes you look untrustworthy.
I'm more along the lines with Elizabeth, like, oh, okay, if your budget's only $5,000, then how do we adjust it to keep our margin? Now, the only time I could see, and I've never really talked about this with a client because I've never ran into the situation, but the only time I could see maybe a break-even project would be is if you haven't figured out how to keep your December or January full and you have trucks sitting around, you have guys sitting around. Okay, well, if you can do that, but still there's a cost and you're not, it's almost costing you at a break even. At a break even, in my mind, costs me money. Because I haven't made any money. I'm putting assets out on the road. I'm putting liability out there. I'm putting exposure out there. And now it's really costing me if it's making me zero.
I will see it. I'll say my one, like, we've kind of talked about this, Sean, but my one, like, maybe I'll do that, is if this is a repeat customer who does a lot of business with me, and this is just like, hey, this one thing happened. We don't have a big budget for it, but can you make it work? If it's at my break even, I won't lose money on it. I'm going to repeat that slower. I will not lose money on it, but I might not make any money. In that scenario, that would be the one time I'd say.
Well, see, and even in that scenario, because I had a couple of those, I would have the conversation with the client like, okay, I can help you on this one. Can we make it up on a different project? And they're like, oh yeah, no problem. The boss is just busting me on this one. I got to stay within this budget, but yeah, next time around, yep, let's make up for it on that. Okay, cool.
And there's also other things you can talk to them about too, right? Like if you covered all your shop's overhead and, you know, all the salaries and all that stuff were covered for the month, and you had a little time in your schedule. Gosh, I got my thumbs up thing going again. So, you know what I mean? Like, you're in the scenario that Elizabeth just said, and you know, like, okay, I still have a little router time to use up. I still have a little bit of truck time I could use up. Sure, I'll help you out this time. But it always has to come with, if it's going to bump any job in any way, the answer has to be no. Right? You can't just squeeze a job in last minute, especially when it's, you know, not at the regular full margins.
I was going to say, the problem too is if it's not an existing client, like Elizabeth and I were just talking about, well, now you set a precedence with a new client that you don't want to have, because they're going to be like, well, last time you were, you know, cheaper.
If that's the first time that person is coming to give you business, and that's the business you give them, it's not the partner you want going forward. Like, that's not it.
You're digging. That's you're not going to make you money. That will not help you grow in the right way.
No. 100%. Oh, well, I was just going to say, we didn't define break-even point. And I feel like we think that everyone should know that. And they should. But what's a break-even point, Sean? Enlighten us.
On a job, or you mean for the whole shop? Like,
well, I think Let's give a general definition of what a break-even point is. And then on a job, obviously, I feel like that'll be self-explanatory.
It's all your costs, variable, hard, everything. So are we talking about, but are you asking break-even point per month, per day?
That would be per month. Right. So I think this month.
A break-even point is going back to that 12 months, you know, what, 12 months and then four, how did I say it? 12, a year divided by 12 divided by four divided by 40. Now there's your break-even point per hour, you know, plus materials. So plus materials. But if you can break your cost down to that, now you've got your hourly cost for anything. Whether you're cleaning toilets, whether you're doing a project, you know, it's just adding whatever materials are over and above that and your market.
I think that understanding that and understanding that all of those things need to be taken into account when you're quoting a job is imperative to profitability in your company. If you don't understand that when you're quoting a job, you have to think about how much time it's going to take employee resources, right? How much time for each department it's going to take to handle this job. Department being administration, sales. If you don't have a sales team and you're not thinking commissions and you're just handling sales internally, then how much time are you putting into that sale? If you're not charging for design up front, we need to have another conversation, but you also have to add those hours in. You know, all of these things are a factor in your quote. It's not just material. So if you're feeling like you're quoting all these jobs and it's just not, you're not profitable because all you're thinking about is, oh, here are the materials for this job and here's my installation cost or here's my fabrication labor. Well, you're leaving out a whole other side of your business that you're not accounting for in quoting that job. So you're never going to be, your margin's never going to be what you want.
Well, and the other factor too is going back to the 12 months, you know, annual divided by 12 divided by 4 divided by 40, is if you're not making the margins at the end of the year that you want, or even per project, if I'm charging the same rate for my production as I am for my designer, but my designer I'm paying, let's go back to my salary. And okay, so if I'm paying production person 40, I'm paying my designer 50,000 annually. Okay, well, I have a $10,000 spread that I didn't take into account. I'm just taking an average over the whole year. So if you break it down into departments, and then through your estimate, you're breaking that, and even your equipment, because we haven't talked about any equipment costs here. If you do, you own them with cash, but there's still a cost because you're going to have to replace that after so many years, hours, miles, months, whatever it is. So, yeah. So, I mean, you've got all those variables. So if someone geeks out, like sounds like Elizabeth and I do, you get down real down and deep on those. You can be very accurate. And I think that was part of why we sold as easy as we did, was because I had it dialed into that, you know, like that was my right side, left side, whichever one it is. I always forget. I think both sides simultaneously, so it doesn't much matter. But
that's a perfect circle right there. Like, look, we started with, if you are looking to sell, the first thing you need is valuation. We're ending with, if you are looking to sell, the second thing you need is very clean, detailed books.
Yes. And be able to pull reports and more reports. Yeah. More reports.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes into it. But okay. So as you did grow your business, and I know we're kind of winding this down here, but what would you say was one of the most important things, or the most important thing that created the most value for the business and for you, like your work, you as a, your work life, your life, you know what I mean? Like as you grew the business and thinking about, like, as you did get closer to an exit, like what was the thing that helped create the most value for your business?
Yeah. I think the value for the business was, like we just said, the dialed in and understanding the numbers. And we could show that for me personally as a business owner. A long time ago, even in the parking lot maintenance business, we stopped Sundays. So parking lot maintenance business, usually Saturday, Sundays are your majority days you're working because places are open Monday through Friday. So, but we stopped Sundays and went, Sundays is family and worship day. Wow. Boy, I had clients that were like, no, we need you coming Sunday. I'm like, well, then we're not the people for you. Well, now when I went to the sign industry, I went, well, we're not working Saturdays either. You know, and to go back to a story, I was going to interject this before. We had met with our competition. We had a couple young guys come into town and they opened up and they were phenomenal installers. The one partner could sell ice to Eskimos and the other partner was a phenomenal installer on vinyl graphics. So we farmed out the installation. So I'm like, I got a meeting set up. My brother and I went and met with them and we're like, hey, you know, we don't work Saturdays and Sundays. We work 40 to 50 hours a week. We're doing this, but our strengths are here. Your strengths are here. If we merged together, this would be a fantastic company, you know, just nailing it. And they're like, their answer back, and this goes back to 70 hour prison. Well, we enjoy right now, or I guess maybe it's our infancy stage. We enjoy working Saturdays and Sundays. And I'm like, well, okay, fun. I enjoy my Saturdays and Sundays off. You know,
you can lie to yourself all you want. You don't enjoy it.
Yeah. And it was back to that pride. Like they even said it. It was hilarious. They go, I guess it's the pride. It's the, we're young and we're new to this. And I'm like, okay, well, if you can't see the value in a Saturday and Sunday for yourselves and, you know, making more money and we all strengthen each other, combining together. So that was just a funny thing. But yeah, I made sure Saturdays and Sundays we didn't work. We didn't work past, say, 6 was an average, if we even got past 5. Typically, it was a 5 o'clock, you know, 8 to 5 business. And we just created it. And how do we create efficiencies and processes to stay within that 8 to 5, but still crank? And so, yeah, I had one guy who I found out after he quit because one of my phrases was working smarter and not harder. Well, he had taken that somehow personally, even though when I gave me, yes, when I gave the examples, when I would say that in a meeting, I'd be like, so I can work on this better if I'm getting smarter at it, not harder. He took it personally and went, oh, you called me stupid, but never said it to me, said it to our manager and quit. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like,
we had an employee quit in a walkout fashion because of an email sent company wide that was like, hey, just these are the tasks of the office. And they thought it was like directed at them. And it was just like I'm like, what? And I do want to say for the people that are working Saturday and Sunday and do take that as a badge of honor and pride, I hope you're taking 2 days off elsewhere because you can't work 7 days a week. Like you can wear that badge of honor now, but you're going to make mistakes. It's going to end up costing you money, whether that's through burnout or just like you're not taking any time off and mistakes happen. And especially when you're tired or you're overworked and the more mistakes happen, the more it costs you money. And the more that job costs you money, the less you're profiting. So
and then it'll affect your team. It'll affect your health.
Absolutely. All those things. So it's really not a badge of honor. I think it's a badge of, time. And
it's almost a badge of not, yeah, it's a lack of knowledge. It's a lack of knowledge and understanding more than it is a badge of honor.
Yeah. I think it's just time and wisdom that tells you it's not because none of us have done it. I think it's just time and wisdom that
time
tells
does
you, like,
call for right. Once in a great
yeah.
while.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. But your norm, it shouldn't be your norm. My second favorite part in this episode, because I got nerdy questions and that's exciting. But this is typically my favorite part of the episode where we do our rapid fire questions. So Joe has changed them. I'm not sure I like them, but we'll work with them. So what is the craziest project you've ever done?
And live to tell about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Oh, well, I guess I'll go back to this was like the first or second week we owned the business. So when we bought the business, we had a 15-inch Gerber. I don't even remember what model, but you would put weights on it to cut the vinyl. So you would put 3 weights on for calendar, 2 weights on for cast, and 1 weight on for, or vice versa, 3 for reflective. And so we could only cut 14.5 inches. Well, I came out of the parking lot business. And I have a 14.5-inch plotter. Luckily, the week we bought it, we were introduced to the lady down the street who did work for the Million Decal company that I discussed. And she had a 36-inch plotter, a 48-inch plotter. And she said, anytime you need anything, you know, holler at me. Well, we get a call from the mall who we used to do parking lot striping for. She says, hey, we've got a barricade. We need graphics on it. And I'm like, okay, a barricade's a 2x4 sawhorse. Why do I need to come out and look at a sawhorse? Just tell me what you want on it. And so I go out, I meet with her. We walk out into the mall and she says, okay, there's the first wall. It's 40 foot by whatever, 14 foot tall. We want our logo as big as we can make it. And I'm like, in my head, I'm going 14.5 inches. Okay. She goes, So I'm thinking about 4 foot by 8 foot, multicolor, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, okay, got that. I'm like, oh yeah, no problem. Where's the next one? And then, you know, then of course on the way home, like, hey, Penny was her name. Hey, Penny, got a project. Can I stop by? You know, and she's like, oh yeah. And she went out and actually got in the scissor lift with my brother and I. She cut all the vinyl. We just set up the files. And so needless to say, within 6 months, we had a 54 inch rubber or whatever. Cause I was like, no, we're not doing that again. But yeah, it was like, you know, of course, after we're walking away to the car, it's like, how are we going to do this? Oh my gosh, this is crazy. You know,
I said yes to something I have no idea how to do. Yeah.
Oh, I learned how to do that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely did that a lot too. Okay. So there's been a ton of great advice through this whole conversation, but if you could, the guy that's just starting up, right? Like he super excited, got his first little digital printer or whatever, you know, whatever he's going to do. What would be one just little golden nugget that you would advise?
Learn what your strengths are and what your likes and dislikes are. So what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are your likes and dislikes? Because that'll kind of guide you where you can go, at least in the infancy stages. So if you can design well, then you can go into printing. Can you afford a printer? So on and so forth. If you can't design well, how are you going to do your front end? So really defining those. And then maybe your strengths are, I had a designer who also tested great for production. Well, he hated production and really he sucked at production too. I tried him. So I'm like, okay, I'll make you happy and I'll let you try it. No. So like even with your strengths, they might not be your likes or dislikes. So make sure they combine. And then, you know, back to the old adage, like then your job is not really a job because you like what you're going in to do and you're good at it.
So. Just a good old SWOT analysis. I like it. 100%. Classic.
And if you can afford it, build the relationships. So I used to go in and I had relationships where I'd, you know, during the parking lot phase, I'd walk in and, hey, Joe, how you doing? And hey, I don't need any parking lot maintenance, you know? And I'm like, oh no, I was just going to see, how's the family? What's up? Do you have a minute to talk? And they'd be like, oh yeah, sit down, talk, you know? And then sure enough, next time they needed something, there was no competition. It was, you know, so if they can afford to do that, it's go out and get some face-to-face and get relationships going to where they're top of mind awareness.
And then I have my last one that Joe cut out, but I put back in because it's my favorite. What is the hardest lesson you wished, or the biggest lesson you wished you didn't learn the hard way?
Does it have to be in the sign industry? Okay. This is a good one then. So after we sold, we got out of the sign business and I jumped into a partnership. I jumped into it knowing in my head, like I should do due diligence, da, 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 but it was a past client. I thought I knew him very well. So they already had an LOI signed. 4 weeks after I talked to him, we own a business. We move it in the back of the building we own. And 4 months later, roles weren't defined. I hadn't signed a operating agreement for some reason. So while I'm in North Carolina, business is in Indiana. My partner forges my name on the operating agreement, sends it to our bank. And I get a call from the banker because before I had left, I had said, hey, you're not going to get this document. Like you do what you got to do, but you're not going to get it. I'm trying to get him to buy me out. I'm done. And so he calls me, says, hey, I got your document. You signed, the manager of the bank. And I'm like, no, you didn't. He goes, yeah, I got it, but you're right. No, you didn't sign it because I pulled your card because I had other accounts there. He's like, I pulled your signature account. Plus we had our conversation. So yeah, this is going to our fraud department. So I learned if you're going into, like, Joe, you had a partner, it sounds like you had a good partnership. I learned define roles. I mean, and this works in any business. Define roles, define expectations, have everything in place. What kind of communication? You know, obviously I can talk. I've got a gift of gab, and my partner would not meet with me. He would not communicate with me from like the week after we closed on the business. And so defining all of that, how are you going to communicate? What roles are you going to do? What are the expectations of either partners or employees or whatever? Don't leave anything open-ended because it will bite you at some point, sometime. And
that's such a good lesson.
Yep.
And now maybe someone won't learn it the hard way. Joe, you learned that lesson the hard way too.
I did. I learned the lesson the hard way, but I've already talked to my therapist about it, so we don't have to.
That's good. Okay.
I'll give you another one too. I think this one's huge.
Yes, absolutely.
Preparing for the storm is the way I say it. So my wife lost her memory at 39. Just woke up one day, memory's gone, never came back. Okay, obviously we did not prepare for that specific event, but we had processes in place at the shop where I could say, okay, you know, like I didn't show up that day, obviously didn't even call, you know, we're dealing with life. But then later on, it's like, okay, I won't be in the shop for a month. You know, if you got an emergency, call me. If not, leave me alone. I'm taking care of family and that's it. And so it's preparing for the storm that is going to come. It's not an if it comes, it's a when it comes. So we had, you know, like Joe, you and I don't know if Elizabeth, how far back you go, but we lived through the 2000, you know, are all the computers going to die and freak out when, you know, it flips to the year 2000 and then. Yep. And 9/11 and COVID and, you know, the 2008, 2009 recession. None of us saw those coming, you know? So it's like, are you prepared or are you not prepared? You know, so we got to weather those storms by being prepared, whether it's savings, whether it's processes, whatever it is. So weathering, you know, like preparing for the storm that's going to come at some point in time.
Well, Sean, it has been a joy to interview you today. You are a gem of a guy and you're out there helping people and that's great. And just so everyone knows, we are going to put all of Sean's information in the show notes so you can get a hold of him. And Sean, if people reach out to you to like set up an initial meeting with them, a phone call, or I don't know exactly how you work, but.
Call it the coffee call or discovery call. And yep, you go to yourbizcoach.biz and there's a spot you can download my book. I've got a little book, 12 steps to double your profit without spending any money. So yourbizcoach.biz and you can follow through. You can see all the verbiage and bear with me. I'm working on making it a little bit more aesthetically pleasing and not so wordy.
No, it's pretty good. I went through the entire thing. It was really good. So, and Sean, you know, we'll make sure we have all the links and stuff in the show notes too. So if you want to just send everything over to me the way you want it presented in the show notes, Elizabeth and I are happy to get that in there. Yeah.
And then, for our listeners too, just know that we're going to see Sean again later on. He might not know that yet, but we will. We're going to talk about exit strategies and selling just a little later on in the year, because I also think that's an important conversation for people. And he's definitely an expert on that. So
yeah, Sean would love to have you back for that. So
yeah,
it'll be fun. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you, Sean. And we'll see you again soon.